Well, I'm going to try to fit into our series on Proverbs today, but it's not going to be so much teaching Proverbs. Teaching it is, I would like to encourage you in your personal devotions and your own daily Bible reading, how you interact with the Word of God, and how you're mentored by the book of Proverbs by God. As you read Proverbs and just the life issues and very practical decisions that you make every day, that's what I'm aiming for. And I want to try to do this by some storytelling, which I know some of you can spin a pretty good yarn, probably better than I can. I know for sure that Michelle can. And well, I'm going to give it a try this morning, and a story on how Proverbs has impacted my life. But before I do that, and before we to launch us off, I'd just like to ask you a question. What do you think several thousand years ago, when the Holy Spirit moved upon a man in a different place, in a different time, King Solomon, to write down these sayings of the wise, the Holy Spirit having us in mind, what was the purpose that God intended for Proverbs for us? I'm listening.
Guidelines?
Guidelines? Certainly can't argue with that. Any other thoughts? Okay, well, if we open the book of Proverbs, the first chapter and the first verses, this is what we find. This is the purpose of the book. To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance, to understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and the riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. So I'd like to just look at this a little bit as we start off. And I think it's already been shared here that we know Proverbs is a book of poetry, and that Hebrew poetry is not about rhymes, but it's couplets, where the second sentence plays off the first sentence. It could be just repeating the first sentence in different words, or a contrast to the first sentence. So Proverbs is given to know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight. It's interesting, you know, you have words of insight, you may not understand them. In Proverbs, as we apply Proverbs to your life, it seems, I think, a general principle about the Bible that understanding and insight comes from application. I tend to think the other way around. I need to understand something before I know what to do. But it seems like when you practice the truths of God, then the insight comes. And Proverbs is given that we can understand the words of insight. To receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity. How to deal with people in a wise way. So equity is just a word, it means fairness. So how to deal with people in a way that is just and fair and good. And that isn't always easy, is it? To do all three. What's the fair thing here? But what's also the righteous thing? What's fair to me? What's fair to the other person? Proverbs is given to help us in that. How to deal wisely with people. To give prudence to the simple. knowledge and discretion to the youth. The simple, you have these categories as we've seen in Proverbs where you have the foolish and the wise, the wicked and the righteous, the loose woman, and the simple. The simple means, I had to look this word up in my Hebrew reference Bible, in my, you know, Strong's Bible. And it means naive and foolish. So it's just kind of being a sucker, being an easy mark. So Proverbs is to give prudence to people that are like that. They're kind of not, you know, they're naive. They're easy to be trapped or ensnared or be led astray. And knowledge and discretion to the youth. Discretion is knowing right from wrong, knowing what's the appropriate, what's inappropriate. And young people, of course, they haven't had a lot of life experiences. So Proverbs helps to do the prudent thing, to do the appropriate thing when you don't have a lot of life experience, not to be naive. Well, I look at this and I say, well, that's not me. I don't fit in the category of youth anymore, unfortunately. Well, the next verse says, for the wise, let the wise hear, and they'll increase in learning. So Proverbs is also for the wise and for the understanding person. You can obtain guidance. To understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. And Proverbs is kind of a genre. It's not like the same type of literature as, say, the Ten Commandments. It's not a list of commands. And some of it is kind of like a riddle, like 24, verse 24, chapter 24, verse 5. I believe I got that right. It says, don't answer a fool according to his folly, lest you become like him. And verse 6, the next verse says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. So what are you supposed to do when a fool argues and says something? Are you supposed to answer him or not answer him? Well, it's kind of like a riddle, isn't it? Well, if you answer him and you sink to his level, you become like he is. You engage in a dialogue with him. So, but it's, if you don't answer him, he thinks he's right and he's wise in his own eyes. So you think about that and it gives you wisdom and wise dealing, how to respond in certain situations. Then it says, the fear of the Lord is the starting point. Many verses in the Bible say, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Here in this translation, it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And I know we've talked about what the fear of the Lord is. It's reverence, but I think it's a lot more than that. We've been going through Hebrews in our home Bible study. It talks about, it's kind of interesting to me, in Hebrews, it talks about having so much confidence and assurance. Just you can barge into the Holy of Holies, into the very presence of the Lord with boldness because of the blood of Christ, with full assurance. And in the very next passage it says, if we neglect so great a salvation, our God is a consuming fire. What a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And if an animal touched the mountain where the Ten Commandments was given, he would have to be killed. How much more if we neglect such the message that's been given to us? So there's this sense of being assured and safe and bold before God because of what Christ has done. But it's not come at the expense of lessening God. That there's many times we see in the Bible fear and trembling before God. So it's a tremendous awe, tremendous respect, and even an element of fear when we approach God. And that's what Solomon says here is the starting point of wisdom, is having that fear. that type of fear, that healthy respect before God. We're not a God-fearing nation, I don't believe, as a rule, or even in our churches, a God-fearing people, many of us we've gotten, I think, very to take God very lightly. And but Michael Cohen, who now sits in prison at his sentencing, and I don't mean to venture into politics here because I have political opinions, but they can be wrong. And there's enough corruption, in my opinion, in both parties. But he made this statement. He said, "I blame myself for the crime that brought me here. Blind loyalty led me to choose darkness over light." And then he warned others not to follow his example. So Michael Cohen was a very intelligent man. He was very smart. He was a lawyer. And my question is, was he wise? What makes a person wise? Why is the fear of the Lord the beginning of wisdom? I read an article once, I think it was written by a journalist, about the effect of the Oval Office when you walk in there, that strong men cower, just the trappings of history and of power and the atmosphere that surrounds it. It just is very intimidating. And how can a man who is at the pinnacle of power, of earthly power, worldly power, and when everyone else is going along with what's expected, and his career can be threatened, how does he stand up against that? If he's asked to do something that is unethical or illegal, can you imagine the pressure? It's easy for me to sit here and judge, but can you imagine the pressure when you could be publicly humiliated, when all your colleagues are going with the flow, and if you refuse or recuse yourself or resign, what the repercussions that are? How could a man withstand that kind of pressure? I would say, if you fear God, you can do it. If you fear God. And it's the fear of God that gives, it's the beginning of wisdom. That's something Michael Cohen said. He chose darkness over light because he was blindly loyal. He followed orders. I think that the fear of God is something that goes deep within a person, where he'll pay any price, he's ready to face death. And that will affect the way you approach the book of Proverbs. You approach it, it's not for the idle or for the curious or for someone that just, "Oh, that's interesting, I wonder what I think of that." But when you're submitted to God and you approach it in that light, you hear it differently. You hear the word of God differently when you come with that fear and trembling submitted to God's authority. And that's the beginning point as we approach Proverbs. Okay. I was talking to my daughter, and she sometimes hears things about me from the past. And she says, "Dad, why didn't you ever tell me about that?" And I don't know. I don't have an answer. And that happens enough times. She says, "Dad, you should write it all down. You should write a book. Why don't you write it down and write a book?" And I said, "Well, if I did, nobody would believe it." And I'm serious. I don't think they would believe it. But she says, Dad, I would believe it. And I started thinking about that. And that we have a responsibility from the scriptures to pass on a heritage to our children and to their children. And we live in an age when there's kind of this false sense of connection through Facebook. We feel we have a relationship or we're connecting, and we're really not on a deeper level. And the media, we don't trust the media anymore. We're being manipulated so much by there's huge organizations that track us and feed us information in order to manipulate how we vote or how we think or whether what we buy. But I still remember, you know, I got a lot of spankings when I was growing up, and my mother would cut a switch off the tree, and those things stung, you know. And if I tried to put my hands behind, then I'd get spanked for that, so I'd have to stand there. And to this day, I was just thinking a few years ago, I can't remember what I was punished for. I got lots of lectures. I can't remember one of them. I can't remember why I was ever punished or what the lecture was about. Maybe it's selective memory. Maybe it's merciful. But when the things I do remember, I remember my grandmother telling me stories about her childhood. And I can tell you those stories verbatim. And she told me about how her mother told her about when the Confederate Army came through Virginia and through her farm in Crockett, Virginia, and the rebel troops took all of their livestock and all of their food. This Confederate soldiers, because I guess they were starving or they were hungry. And they had one horse that no one could saddle it except the slave that they had. And the Confederate said, we're going to shoot the horse if you don't saddle it. So they saddled the horse and they took the horse too. Stories like that, you won't find them in a history book. But I believe them because I knew my grandmother and I heard them firsthand. She used to tell me stories about preacher Bob Sheffy that maybe some of you heard about. And I read the book about Bob Sheffy and I think, it's hard to separate legend from fact, you know. But I know what my grandmother told me, and she was an eyewitness to it. He was in her home. So I read this in Isaiah. For the Lord spoke thus to me with his strong hand upon me and warned me. I'm sorry. That was about the fear of God. We'll go on. This is just that. Don't call conspiracy what other people call conspiracy. Let your fear and let your dread be the Lord. Anyway, I missed that point. We'll go on. Exodus 10. And that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Lord. So God is saying all of these judgments I brought against the nation of Egypt to bring you out of slavery. You're to tell these to your children, your great-grandchildren, and so they pass on this heritage, so they will know that I am the Lord. This history had a purpose for future generations. In Psalm 105, it says, oh, give thanks to the Lord, call upon his name, make known his deeds among the peoples. Sing to him, sing praises to him, tell of all his wondrous works. Glory in his holy name. Let the hearts of those who seek the Lord rejoice. Seek the Lord in his strength. Seek his presence continually. Remember the wondrous works that he has done. Remember them, his miracles, and the judgments he uttered. So this is our responsibility to tell these stories, these personal experiences of what God has done. Psalm 78, I will open my mouth in a parable. It's a storytelling. Jesus taught with parables, right? He used stories, narrated. I will utter dark sayings from of old, things that we have heard and known, that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, but tell them to the coming generation, the glorious deeds of the Lord and His might, and the words that He has done. So this is Jesus. In the message, it says, with many stories like these, Jesus presented His message to them, fitting the stories to their experience and maturity. He was never without a story when He spoke. When He was alone with His disciples, He went over everything, sorting out the tangles, untying the knots. So I want to get into my story here. And when I was growing up, well, my mother died when I was 13 years old, just turned 13. She struggled with alcoholism. And she told me, well, there were many times I thought she had quit, and then she would start again. And then I wouldn't see her sober for 3 or 4 months. And then every time I thought, well, I hope this is it, the end of it, she stopped. But then something would happen, and it would be triggered, and she would start again. But then there was one time that she stopped, and somehow, I was 12 years old, but intuitively I knew she would never drink again. And she said to me, Steve, help me to get straightened out, and then we'll straighten your dad out. So my dad was also an alcoholic. And but a short time, and I knew, I don't know how I knew, I didn't know Christ at the time, but inside I knew this was it, that something had happened. I don't know what it was. But then shortly after that, she went into the hospital, and within a week she died from breast cancer. So my dad, of course, he loved me, he loved my mother, and my mother loved me, but he says to me, well, Steve, I'm through with drinking. We're going to read the Bible every day. And that lasted for about a week. And then one day he said, I talked to your grandparents, and they said it's okay to take a social drink now and then. And my heart just sank, although I was 13 years old, I knew that was not a good idea for him. And pretty soon I was pretty much on my own. I always longed to be with my dad or see my dad, but when he wasn't working, he was drinking, or he was on the weekends with his drinking friends, or just not sober. So I missed my dad's presence growing up. And when I came to Christ, I was 17, 18 years old, and I went to Virginia Tech, and I was told there by some Christians that, well, you need to spend time every day with God, and that's how you'll get to know Him. You read the Bible, and you pray. He speaks to you through the Bible, and you speak to Him in prayer, and you build a relationship with God like that. And there was a little pamphlet I was given, 7 minutes with God. And I thought, oh, 7 minutes, I can do that every day. 7 minutes without fail. And that's the whole idea was, everybody thinks, well, I can do at least 7 minutes. If it's 30 minutes, you think, oh, I'm busy. Oh, I slept in late. I don't have time. But 7 minutes, you know, at least 7 minutes. And then 7 minutes becomes 10 minutes. And 10 minutes comes to 30 minutes, and that's no sin. You can do 30 minutes, that's all right, but at least 7 minutes. So 3 minutes reading the Bible and 3 minutes in prayer. And I remember after reading that pamphlet, I was sitting in my dorm room and I read that, and I was so excited. And so the next morning I got up very early and went out behind the campus into some woods there with my Bible. And I was just, I'm going to meet God. And I opened my Bible, and the Bible's pretty big. I didn't even know where to start or what to read. And I have been given this verse to memorize on assurance of answered prayer, and it's John 16:24. Hitherto you have asked nothing in my name, asking you shall receive, that your joy may be full. So I just thought, well, I'm just going to read that verse. So the first time I really heard that verse, it was like Jesus was saying, Steve, up to now you haven't asked for anything in my authority. Just to ask, and you'll receive, and your joy may be full. I thought, really? I thought, what can I ask? I didn't know what to pray. I just was so excited. And I thought, well, I'll be real spiritual here. I'll ask for something spiritual. I said, well, there's this guy across the hall from me in the dorm. His name is Ford. Lord, just give me an opportunity to witness to Ford today and give me the courage to speak up. And so I went back to my room and I was fooling with a tape recorder I was working on. And who walks in the room but Ford? And he starts talking to me, and my heart's thumping. Now's the chance. God, answer my prayer. I need to talk to him. Chickened out. He walked out. God, I just beat myself up. You answer my prayer. I didn't have the courage. And just give me the courage and please forgive me and so on. Ford walks back in the room. I have a second chance. Again, I weasel out. He walks out. I beat myself up. And the third time he walks in, and I guess God just decided he had to give me a little push. And he says, Steve, my girlfriend's a Catholic. What do you think of Catholics? So he made it easy for me. But that was the way it started, my relationship with God. I'm just so excited to spend a little time with him and get to know him. And he did answer my prayers and give me joy. And when I read Proverbs, you read Proverbs, it's kind of like, a lot of the passages are like, my son, listen to me. It's like a father talking to his son. And maybe it was, part of it is Solomon recounting David talking to him. I'm not sure, but I didn't know the verse at the time, but the Bible says God will be a father to the fatherless. And so I feel that God mentored me through Proverbs. It was like having a father-son talk that I never had. I'd sit down with the father and say, here's how this is what my dad did have one father-son talk to me, I remember. I was sitting out on the front porch of our house. Our house was on Main Street. And he said, Steve, my dad was kind of short like I am. He said, a Slater never walks away from a fight. He said, you might get beat up, you might not win, but you're not a chicken. So if I ever walk away from my fight, my big brother, Uncle Ralph, he was big. He said he would take care of me. He would beat me up. So he says, you never walk away from a fight. And we lived about a half a block up from what then was the Whitfield bus terminal. And there were some hoods that hung out there in the back of the bus terminal, and I was halfway afraid of them. They kind of had a reputation. My dad gave me that talk, and I got all puffed up, and I thought, no Slater ever walks away from a fight. I'm going down to the bus terminal. And I walk down the bus terminal. Instead of going the front door, I walk around to the back door where I knew these guys would be, and they were there. And I start to walk in the door, and one of them steps over in front of me, and I bump him out of the way. And all of a sudden, all his buddies are urging us on. And so we get into a fist fight. And this guy, I won't say his name because he might be listening, but he had a reputation. And I was petrified, but I uppercut. And anyway, I just say, I won the fight, to my great surprise. And then I walked away. And the next morning, I got on the school bus to go to school, to high school. And as the school bus pulled in the parking lot, I look out the window, and there he is waiting for me. I thought, oh no, my heart goes up. And I got off the bus and stuck out his hand and shook my hand. And I got all over the high school. Steve beat up so-and-so. And boy, did I ride high for a week or two. That was my father-son talk. I'm sorry I diverted so much. That's what I read, and that's the way Proverbs is. It's like a father. Son, as you go through life and you have these situations, here's the way you handle them. This is what you do. This is wisdom. And so I'm going to fast forward a few years. I was in Long Beach, California. Didn't have much money. I was of the mindset that I should just trust God for my finances and serve Him. My roommate came to Christ. He was Hawaiian. He went to this little Methodist church there in Long Beach. And the pastor just become born again. He'd been a minister for 20 years, but he'd just gotten saved. So my roommate encouraged me to go with him to church. And at the church, they asked me if I would teach a Sunday school. It was three junior high boys. And I thought, well, that's safe. I can handle that. So I agreed. One of these boys was a single mother, no father. One of the boys from a very upper-class neighborhood. So I thought I could handle them, but I couldn't. They didn't pay attention. They didn't listen. They didn't sit there and take notes as I taught the class. But God showed me how to connect with them. And over time, we grew to have a lot of boys. No girls for some reason, but a lot of boys. They'd come over to they'd memorize scripture. They'd come over to my apartment in the morning before school, and we'd have a quiet time together. We just had a lot of fun together. I did things with them, and I think I was kind of like a father figure. This kid from the upscale neighborhood, I noticed, well, in those days, I lived in a lady's garage. I substitute taught when I needed some money. But I just trust God for my needs. So God's called me to minister. And that was my thinking at the time. But the car I drove was a real eyesore. And so when I would drive to this guy's neighborhood, he'd look around to see if any of his friends were looking before he'd get out of the car. He didn't want to be associated with the car. I used to tease him a little bit about it. But then I started to hear feedback from some of the parents. A lot of the parents were very supportive, but they weren't so sure they wanted their kids hanging out with this bum who drove this beat up old car and didn't work and wasn't married. And I would look like a shady character. And I began to hear some of this talk, and I didn't know quite what to do. So that summer we took two carloads of kids to a summer camp in Colorado Springs. The Navigators have a camp in the Rocky Mountains there. These kids didn't have any money, so we would go out and paint the house numbers on the curb of the sidewalk in neighborhoods, and then people would give us donations. And we did that for a month to raise the money to pay for the camp. The last day before we had to leave, we only had half the amount of money we needed. So that last day, we all got together, all these boys, and we prayed, God, we need this money. And then we went out, and we worked until it was dark, through the night partly. We just got so many requests. And then that last day, we took in more money than all the other days up to then. And it just a couple dollars over our goal. So then we went off to Colorado. My roommate drove one car, I drove the other. So we got there, and I asked a guy who I looked to as a mentor. He had been the navigator director in Virginia when I had been a student. And I said, Jim, these parents, I'm trusting God and He's providing and I have this ministry, but the parents think I'm a bum and I'm not sure what I should do. He said, Steve, it's simple. I think you should get a good job. And I said, so we prayed. And we prayed that God would give me a good job and drove back to California. And I didn't have the radio on the whole trip, but I just, for some reason, impulsively reached over and turned on the radio. And the radio said, it was a news, and it was back in the days when CB radio was becoming really popular. And they were talking about how this is going to be a big thing, and it's the businesses that will profit the most off of this will be those that offer service, that can service the radios. And I reached over and turned off the radio, said, I know what I'm going to do. Because just a few months earlier, I've always been interested in electronics, ham radio license. And just on a fluke, I said, I'm going to get my first class commercial license. And I studied for the exam, and I took the exam and passed it and got this first class commercial license for no reason other than just to have it, just for the fun of it and the enjoyment of it. I got it. And the only person in those days that could service these any kind of a radio with a transmitter in it had to have a first class commercial license. I said, well, I'm qualified. That's what I'm going to do. So when we got back home, I talked to my landlord and he had an old shack out back. I said, can I use that building? And he said, yes. So I went around to all the CB dealers in Long Beach and said, I'll pick up any radios you have that are having problems and repair them and return them to you in 2 or 3 days. And so suddenly I had lots of business. And what would happen is a customer would come in and be upset that his CB radio wasn't working, and it's probably because the installation wasn't done right. You could short out the antenna or not tune it properly. And rather than being hassled, the dealer would just say, well, just go over there to Slater. He's over there on Signal Hill behind this apartment building. You'll find him in there, and he'll take care of it for you. So all the customers started coming to me, and the trust built. And so one day I saw this little building on Long Beach Boulevard, the major street in Long Beach, right next to the 405 freeway, which was a major freeway of Southern California. Right at that intersection is this little building, and I rented it for almost nothing and opened up my shop. And I guess I had 12 or 15 competitors in the area. And I knew nothing about business. I assumed that everybody was smarter than me, and that was probably a good assumption. And it's a very competitive situation in Southern California in marketing, and these people had a lot more capital. I didn't have any capital, and so some of the things I was told, like I see my competitors making mistakes because they didn't follow the book of Proverbs, and I would make my decisions based on the principles that I was reading. That I had read, I knew from the book of Proverbs. And one of my competitors nearby, he said, Steve, you can't make it in this business unless you do some of the shady side of the business. So there was a shady side. These people that drove the semi-trailers, they had CB radios, they were a major part of the business, and they wanted special frequencies outside the legal frequencies where they were crowded and a lot of other people talking. You could fix the radio or put in certain components so they could operate where nobody else was operating, although it was illegal. You could do that and get away with it. And they would pay a lot of money for it. Another thing they would do, the legal limit was 5 watts of power. And some would boost their power to 100 watts, 500 watts, and they'd have these amplifiers, and they want you to put those in. And so that's where there was a lot of money. And he said, there's no profit in just selling the radios. You've got to do this side business, or you won't make it. I said, well, then I won't make it. And when a few years later, I moved to Russia in 1985, I in Long Beach was, as far as I know, the only business left standing. All my competitors went bankrupt. When the fad died down, and there was attrition, they couldn't make it. But we were still doing good business. And I don't know if that was the reason, but. In the area, there's a University of Southern California, USC, has a very good business school, nationwide reputation. Two graduate students from the business school came to my business and said they wanted to do their thesis on my business and why it had been so successful and so on. And they began to ask me all of this business theory and business jargon and terminology. I didn't know what they were talking about. And I said, well, I just kind of frustrated. I said, well, you know, actually, I run my business out of the book of Proverbs. That's where I get my... He said, oh, well, tell us about that. So we did a little Bible study in Proverbs. I began to show him, and maybe Jonathan will go into this when he talks about finances and Proverbs. But I showed him some and explained how some of the mistakes my competitors had made. And so they wrote their report, and I didn't see them until a few months later. I saw one of the guys, who, by the way, was the older brother of the kid that lived in the affluent neighborhood. And he's a pastor today. But I said, Nick, well, how did your report go? And he said, well, the teacher wrote on my paper that... we did not discuss this in class. You did not cover the principles we went over in class. However, it's an intriguing paper, a very interesting paper, A-. So, Proverbs got an A- from professor of economics at USC. I think I'd like to just go back and close with that little 7 minutes with God and encourage you, if you're not already doing it, to just take that time. And you can't, don't rely on what I say or what Jonathan says or somebody else says, because you forget it. But get into the Word and hear from God Himself. Let Him be your mentor. Come, put yourself at His feet and take it seriously. These principles work. They can be anti, what is the word, anti-intuitive. Or sometimes you may feel like an idiot. Nobody else does. We don't do that here. You know, we don't operate that way. But you step out on the principles of life that God has given us, and you reap the benefits of that.